on buying, I mean, and this is easy to say as someone who, like, this is my livelihood and this is what my passion is, but don't just buy the same bottle every time. Like, your tastes don't grow if you eat the same food every day. Like, you have to push yourself a little bit. So we're really good at that, at helping you. Oh, you like this wine. Seems like you like this region. Let's try something else. So I would say just, even if you go and you're like, oh, I'm going to buy two bottles. If you're really stuck on that one that you love, buy that one and something new.
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat. And considering it is bar month at On Milwaukee, people who drink as well. I am your co-host, as always, Matt Miller, culture editor at On Milwaukee. And I am joined, as always, by the... I got to come up with new puns because it's bar month. I don't know. The queen of drinking. Doesn't quite work as well.
Not quite.
No, no. I should do more show prep. Lori Frederick, culinary writer.
My name
writer.
Is just fine. Thanks.
Yeah. We'll just leave it at that. How are you doing, Lori?
I'm doing really well today.
Yeah.
You know, for a Monday.
We're in March. We're recording this on March 1st.
We are in March, and the sun is shining, and it got a little warmer.
March 2nd.
Got a little warmer this weekend. So.
What year is it? I apparently don't know what day it is.
Well, and this'll run, you know, it'll be.
Yeah. It's still 2019, right?
But I occasionally do write that on things.
The checks.
I don't write checks. You write checks?
I write checks. Oh boy, is this like a weird millennial thing? Where?
No, I mean, I write very occasional checks.
Okay.
Like, I pay very few bills with checks anymore. Like, I think I've had checks.
Yes, we tricked them into talking before being introduced.
Oh, we did. This is Matt's thing. I'm going to introduce them so that this is all good.
This is flowing very naturally, much like natural wine, which is the subject of our podcast today.
It is. And to guide that conversation are people who know more than we do about on that topic. We're here with Allie and Brad Cruz, and they are owners of Nonfiction Wines in Bayview.
Yep, that's correct.
Hi. Thank you for joining us.
And thanks for reminding us we have to write our rent check today. So thank you.
Oh, that's a good reason
this
for checks.
This is why we have this podcast, to help people remind them of their day in, day out.
Let's do this every month.
I bought a house, so I don't write rent checks. Or don't pay rent with a check.
No one needs a humble brag, Lori.
It's not. I'm just saying, like, that's a check that I would probably still write. I would probably still write checks for my rent if I... Because there aren't... Maybe there are better ways. I don't know.
But she was better than you.
I pay a lot of my
this
bills.
This is verified. Lori is better than me in literally every way of life. What people don't know is before we went on this podcast, I needed Lori to write something for me because I was too stupid. So...
You were not.
It's not wrong.
You're just deferring to someone.
Which is a good way of, a more polite way of saying too stupid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Despite all this conversation, I like you, Matt.
Oh, thanks, Lori.
Yeah.
And speaking of things that I'm stupid about, I don't know much about natural wine. All I know is that Action Bronson from Vice loves it and spends multiple hours drinking it and saying not much about it.
We actually have a lot of people that come in because of that show, though. And
really?
And they're always looking for his one, like, holy grail type wine, the Susukaru, which we had, but we do not have anymore. You sell out of that immediately.
Action
but
Bronson?
He's like, really helped up the natural wine movement, I think, for young people, too, especially.
I mean, yeah, that's where I heard about it at first. But I guess this leads nicely into how did you guys find your way to natural wine?
Yeah, because you own you own a shop that you don't just, like, wake up one day and say,
we almost did, though, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
It happened a little quicker than we thought. But it also took a really long time for us to find everything we were really looking for and doing it, to be able to do it the right way.
Right.
So we met, we were both in restaurants for forever, basically, in every respect, you know, bartending, serving, managing, writing wine lists. That's actually kind of how we first got into it. Brad and I, we wrote wine lists for North Star American Bistro. That's where we met, fell in love, all that good stuff. But I know. But we started to realize that, like, most of the wine we were seeing was just kind of boring. And North Star was kind of ahead of the times. They had a huge Louis Dresner portfolio, which...
Yeah, that reserve list had some really, really good stuff for the time. And I mean, not everybody bought those, but...
Yeah,
sure.
But I'm sure you've heard of Louis Dresner.
Yes.
So
for the listeners who haven't, who is Louis Dresner?
It's an importing company.
Okay.
Not really even run by the same people that I think, started it. But still, they've been doing it and kind of focusing on natural wine before it really even had a name attached to it.
They got in before
it wasn't because natural wine, which we're going to define, is not new.
Not at all.
No. I mean, you go way back, and they had no choice but to make natural wine, in the beginning, right? And the wine that your uncle made, you know, in the basement 20 years ago.
Right.
That was natural wine. That was qualified as wine.
Sure? Yeah, I mean
that's true.
In its most technical sense, though, I mean, that would fall kind of in the category. This is somebody kind of...
Yeah, you would hope so. I mean, you never know. They're probably adding commercial yeasts or sugars to, like, you know, get it going.
Oh, sure.
If they lived around here.
Oh, wait, maybe. No. So it does kind of fall outside that category.
It does a little.
If your grandpa's like an old French man who lives in the countryside.
Yeah. Yes, then maybe.
Or in Georgia.
We can all be so lucky.
Yeah.
Right? Yes.
but nonetheless.
But yeah, so we started realizing, like, these wines taste different. They're alive. They're, like, more fun. And I don't know, sometimes with just a commercial wine, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but you taste it and you hear all these nuanced flavors you're supposed to experience and you're like, I don't get that at all.
Oh, yeah. No, that's me for sure.
But
have
then,
you ever seen Party Down?
Of course I have.
The Steve Guttenberg episode. Yes. Where they're like, what are you tasting in this wine?
I taste rocks.
Getting notes of rope? That is literally me.
Yes. But that's actually, I mean, if you would say that, that's what you taste, you're not wrong.
But well, I feel like part of that has been that people have been so determined to, like, create a Pinot that tastes like Pinot or the Cabernet that tastes like, you know, what everyone wants in a Cabernet.
Yeah.
And to do that, you can't just let the grapes go,
right? Exactly.
You have to dick with it, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah. No, I'm glad that we can say that word. Just
like, oh, yeah, no. This is a profanely friendly podcast.
So, I mean, anyway. So you guys got interested, both of you simultaneously?
Yeah, pretty much at the same time, maybe in...
And you gazed at one
different
another.
Different degrees.
And the light bulbs went on.
Yes.
And you fell in love.
Exactly. But yeah, so then we started looking for, you know, the back of the label, looking for Louis Dresner, looking for Kermit Lynch. And then it became, hey, we just found out that we can go to Chicago and, like, find all these crazy cool natural wines. So we would make trips way too often.
Yeah.
Just coming back with cases of wine and learning that way, like, what we like, what we're looking for. And then new importers came into our world.
Yes.
Yes, so a lot kind of them.
So that's the short, kind of condensed version.
So you kind of self-educated yourselves on natural wine on some level.
A little bit. With, like, friends along the way kind of pushing it forward. And there were some places around that were starting to serve those kinds. But again, without really a label or saying why they were different or what they were.
Well, and for me, so for instance, I had dinner at Bacchus last week, week before.
Don't look
time
at me. I don't
together.
Know.
I'm kind of looking around like maybe someone else knows. And I was sort of inquiring, you know, because, I mean, they have a book.
Yeah.
Like a Bible of wines. Mm-hmm. Their collection is huge. And we were talking about, have you added a natural wine section yet? Mm-hmm. And they probably have a smattering on that list. Mm-hmm. But admittedly, like, people are like, it takes so much you know, when people start asking for it, you know, then places will add it.
Yes.
And I think right now, at least in Milwaukee, we have a lot of people interested, but maybe who don't know quite what it is. Hence the podcast.
Yes. How we define natural wine, and I mean, not just we, this is a pretty big, broad statement, but it's wine that you're not adding anything, you're not taking anything away. So that's like no fining, no filtration. That's where like the non-vegan type thing would come in with some of the gross things.
Yes.
And then not adding sugar, not adding mega purple, not adding all these other commercial yeast. Yeah,
additives and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always tell people, it's like, it's a really old world approach where they let the natural yeasts do what the yeasts were doing. Because like, they're not typically adding yeast.
Right.
No.
Or additives or a bunch of sulfites.
Right.
Or, you know, and a lot of times, and tell me if I'm wrong here, there's not a ton of blending. At least not in the same way.
It was a little bit different, I think, in like the very, very old sense of it, I think. But I think sometimes everything would almost get fermented together. Which you're starting to see some people play with that a little bit more now, but and they have been the whole time, I guess.
But you're not looking at how a wine turns out and going, "Oh, this isn't right." So let's blend it with the sweeter thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. Over the years, though, I'm sure that shaped, and that's kind of why certain like famous blends, even just thinking of like a Bordeaux blend, it's like all kind of about creating balance or something. Like you're permitted to use a certain amount of grapes or certain types of grapes and call it that, but you're kind of doing it to balance things out. And you're in some cases trying to create a style, and sometimes those kind of take hold, sometimes they don't, and it's just a fun experiment. But
So, but with a natural wine, you're probably fermenting different grapes together if you think it might be cool.
Yeah, definitely.
But not necessarily playing with them after.
Right. Some still you're do not really best. Manipulating as much.
Because like, a lot of times with with a wine blend, like you'll start with a wine that gets fermented and you'll have another wine over here that gets fermented.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you're tasting the one wine and going, oh, it could use sweetness. Mm-hmm. So let's add something else to it. And that's how blends come about, or at least that's my understanding. And the process for natural wines is not quite that way. Part of it is like the uncertainty,
some people do that, though.
Right?
Yeah.
Is it?
I would say some people still do that, and they'll always still like, not always, but I'm saying certain ones like to do that where they'll vinify them separately, see how that wine turns out, and then kind of create their final blend. And then there's also people who kind of take more of a risk by co-fermenting together and deciding that beforehand. And like, all right, we're putting these together and whatever happens is going to be kind of like, this is our ratio and we can't change it after.
Yeah.
So the benefits of natural wine, what is the obvious, obviously, if you're one of those people who, you know, is reading the label and you're like, oh, I don't like seeing all these words I don't know and stuff like that. Other than that, what are kind of the benefits of natural wine? And well, what is kind of that big differentiation point?
Yeah, first of all, you're never going to have a label that tells you what's in the wine, which that's the scary thing. Like they legally don't have to put it on there. They'll always say contain sulfites. So I always want to tell people that, like, even if they're not adding them, sulfites naturally occur in wine.
Right.
It's going to be in there. And we have to have it on our labels. So that.
But you're not adding a bunch of them.
Right.
Which some of the, and especially the cheaper the wine you go. And my gauge is always like, I mostly will not buy wines under $10 because the cheaper the wine is, the more they bump things up.
Sure.
Like, I mean, they have sulfites.
And
I'm not, I have a somewhat of a sensitivity to the sulfites in wine. A little. I just get peachy, partially from alcohol, partially from, you know, and anyway, so,
but yeah, I don't need that. That's another benefit. The next morning, I mean, it is still wine, obviously. You drink three bottles of it with your friends, you're still going to feel it in the morning, but
well,
it's way
darn it
less.
Now. What's the point?
I know. It's so much less. The hangover is like minuscule in my experience.
And that sort of goes along with that. Like the cheaper the wine, the bigger the hangover. Like you drink really good wine and I think you drink it more slowly.
Yes, that's true.
Because you're tasting something and you're not pounding it.
Lori. your
I've just silenced
your
my
computer
laptop.
Disagrees. The computer wants to pound the wine.
Ding. Lie detector.
Well, we actually, convenient enough, we have some natural wine here.
We brought some.
We have some in glasses. So do we want to do a little taste, a little try?
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, right. Do you want to tell us what you have here?
So the first one that we brought would be...
First one you brought? I didn't know there were multiples.
Well, there's two.
Oh, my God.
It is just like an hour.
Getting hammered on this podcast.
This one's actually kind of from two different projects, but... so it's done under this Le Vin Pirouettes line, which is kind of a new project that Christian Binner, who is already kind of a well-established winemaker in Alsace, started to kind of give a little bit more of a voice to well-made natural wines from people who may have previously been selling off their grapes to like a co-op. So he kind of shepherds them into making wines with no additives and actually like helping them along and has a place for them to put it out, I guess.
That's
kind of a platform
so
to go.
Juicy. Not to interrupt your intelligent conversation with like a real dummy come interject and be like, it's juicy.
It but is
it's
juicy.
Really juicy. Yeah.
Well, and the first thing I think, is this an orange wine? Okay. So, and an orange wine is a white wine that's been fermented with skins?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it has a naturally orange color.
Yeah. So
this, it's also kind of hazy, mm-hmm. which yeah. is probably, it's like a hazy IPA, sort of.
It does in look like ways, an IPA.
It looks like yeah. a hazy IPA.
Yeah.
But that's the lack of filtering.
Yes. Okay, and so, this one would be totally unfined, unfiltered, also no additives at all.
And where is this from?
This one's from Alsace in France.
It's so and smooth.
This is a blend of Gewürztraminer, Pinot Gris, and Riesling as well.
Yes.
I feel like the temperature outside just went up 20 degrees drinking this wine.
Just makes it feel See? Like summer.
It's such a summer flavor. It's, oh my gosh.
It's summer. It's brunch. It's like just, I don't know, dynamite. There's some savoriness to it. Mm-hmm. There's a good amount of like grapefruit and like...
It's not cloying. Yeah.
No, not
like
at all.
Soup, it's not like a sour beer or a kombucha can be where it's no, like...
And it almost has the feeling of effervescence. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Which there might be some.
Which you do get a little bit. You might also get the next one too, even the red that we brought. Sometimes there is a little bit of trapped CO2, so you might get a little bit of effervescence. Mm-hmm. Personally, I like it.
Which is nice.
And I like kind it of too. It does dissipate after a little while. Like some people don't like it and kind of just want to decant it.
But you can
it
rest
kind of,
it out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you can let it go. But
so, really nice.
No, and the Alsatian wines are known for being food friendly. Yeah. And I can just imagine because this has a nice acid level.
Yeah. It's great. So, and like when you said like what would not pair with this, that we had a hard time
yeah.
to think of something that yeah. wouldn't go well.
Yeah, off air I was joking because I brought my requisite soup. and I was like, what would be an all to set up a joke? And you guys were like, I don't know. I mean, something very, very spicy, I guess. But yeah, yeah. this is it's flavorful, but without being intense. Mm-hmm.
And it's a little funky, mm-hmm. which is what mm-hmm. I love yeah. about natural wines is Same. You always get like some flavor. Ooh, my mouth is watering.
Some right?
flavor That's part of it.
That you almost, like you have to think really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, barnyardy French wines mm-hmm. are a thing I love.
Oh, you're going to like
so,
the next.
Yeah, so I'm always looking for, and you know, I like being able to say, oh, that's an ode of, you know, cat pee, mm-hmm. which is a real thing.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
actually a real thing in wine, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. Or barnyard, or yeah. forest floor, or...
The Somme you know. Documentary, when the one guy's just like, yeah. it smells like, I'm getting notes of an opened can of tennis balls.
Yeah. Which yeah. I remember yeah. that smell very vividly.
Yes. 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 yes.
Burning tires.
My brother did, so it was always... Oh, lots yeah. of lots of cans or the tennis ball saver container Ooh, too, yeah. which I don't think really did anything.
Yeah. yeah, some of the like descriptors for natural wines, like it kind of blows your mind when you say, like the other day we had a wine and I wasn't being very complimentary of it, but I was like, it kind of tastes like the inside of someone's purse. Like, and then everyone was like, yeah, it kind of does. Like, so there's just some weird things that you'll... start noticing in mm-hmm. different wines. This one is nothing of that. This
That's
is
an incredible descriptor.
But the nose on this reminds mm-hmm. me so much of kombucha. Mm-hmm. I can't.
It does have a kombucha little tang to it.
Yep.
It does. Which is, you know, that's also the thing where yeah. your first mm-hmm. sniff, it's sort of like a good cheese.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I wonder what that's going to taste like. Because yeah. it doesn't taste how it smells.
It is one of the Only most remotely. Salivating things I've ever
oh,
had.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like it.
A lot of times that can, well, from what I understand too, is like people say that's also a good way to tell almost if it has the native yeasts used.
Okay.
Is kind of that extra little salivary response.
Interesting.
Sort of like a sourdough, I would
yeah.
imagine.
Yeah.
Where you're harnessing wild yeast from the air. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that gives you all sorts of... different flavors.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, absolutely.
So we always try to look for all of the wines that we bring in to only use like mm-hmm. the native yeasts that are already found on the skins as opposed to being used with like a lab one or basically where they would first add a lot of sulfur to kill off the native yeasts and then use right. their own lab one that
so
kind of
you, so you don't keeps get everything what they control. Would consider to be off flavors or unexpected
yeah.
flavors.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole thing like typicity, like we always kind of not argue about it, but it's just like when you're making wine, they're like, oh, it's supposed to taste like this because it's from here and it's this varietal. Like, so that's what they're doing. They're just kind of manipulating it.
Yeah.
Like, but they also manipulate, like, one of the things that I've learned, and I don't know, I feel like I've been shocked the more I learn about wine. Mm-hmm. Like, so a region will get a reputation for a terroir. Mm-hmm. And it'll be like minerally. Mm-hmm. Well, then the farmers, if they're not getting enough minerally from their wines, like yeah. they're supplementing their soil mm-hmm. with minerals.
Right.
And I'm just like, come on, guys. you yeah. know, like that's not true. Like that's not truly taking advantage of the soil you naturally yeah. have.
Exactly.
That's like, you know.
So what kind of brand or what type of wine is this again?
So this one's kind of a weird one to categorize because okay. it's still a blend, but it's also kind of, it's a lot of varieties that would still be used in Alsace anyways.
Okay.
So, I mean, you do see a lot of those in like Edelswicker blends as well too.
Okay.
But this one is also kind of another, when I kind of mentioned the two projects, it's also this Brutal. Mm-hmm. is sort of like almost like an open source label that okay. can be used by different natural winemakers, and you don't really have to pay for anything.
Interesting.
And so it's very culty. You see okay. this, like anything with the Brutal, it's like pretty sought after in the natural wine community. I mean, not to be like, oh, drink it because it's cool, but it's a cool wine. It is.
Yeah. It's so if you're someone who's a wine fan, but maybe doesn't know much about natural wines, is it a pretty easy to be like, I like Pinot Noir, I can shift over to this in natural wine? Or are there different kind of...
That is our aim. We are trying so hard. And not to like ever talk down anyone's taste. You know, some people really do love, you know, just I want an Oregon Pinot Noir. You know, we can find that for you. But if we can like push the discussion, like the conversation a little bit farther, I think we can find you something that's like a little outside the box and a little more fun. I don't know, like,
Something that kind of hits some of those notes and then
yeah, because what's the point on some level of drinking natural wine if you're just going to be kind of trying to drink stuff that's replicating regular wine on
and
some
I think
level?
There are some that are going to be completely the same as like they're going to be made naturally. Mm-hmm. They're still going to taste almost exactly how you expect them to because that's how the vintage turned out. And I think that's where there is some kind of a weird little thing. Everybody expects it to be like one thing or another, or they expect it to be always crazy when it can be very classic. Mm-hmm. It can be very crazy. We try to balance that out and have a little bit of both mm-hmm. so that people who aren't looking to have something that's super barnyardy don't have to get that.
Yes. Yeah.
Like
yes.
they can still drink something that's made well and doesn't have a bunch of additives and it will still taste like something they're familiar with. And if that's what they want, that's totally fine. Like, well,
yeah, and you need to guide people on their journey.
Experiment if they want to.
When people start, they want something familiar, something that's in mm-hmm. a realm that they recognize. But the more they drink natural wines, I'm sure the more they're like, okay, give me the weird stuff. Give me the funky stuff. Give me something that I've never tasted before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've read a lot of pieces where people are like, oh, if you're not an experienced wine taster, don't go natural wines. And I'm just like,
well, bad news. I'm here drinking natural wines.
I know. I completely disagree.
I agree. Disagree completely.
I think that if you've been drinking regular traditional wines for a long time, mm-hmm. you almost have to open your mind to the, you know,
yeah, it's
to the new
to the
interesting
system.
Things. You need to be re-educated.
Yeah. I like this a lot. Frankly, I like this a lot more than tasting regular wines. Just because I feel like when I taste regular wines, like we talked about, I feel like I get a lot of the tannin and a lot of the alcohol. And finding the different notes and stuff, I always feel like an idiot. And like I'm not
which
getting
which you shouldn't have to. It yeah. shouldn't be part of it.
Like, and I just feel like I'm not getting the experience of the wine well enough. I feel like the wines are wasted on me. Whereas like even just this one glass of natural wine, I feel like even as a novice, I'm tasting all these interesting mm-hmm. textures and all these interesting flavors and feeling these senses, this kind of literal salivation. That it's just like, you know, I kind of like the friendliness of natural wine on
it's supposed
some level.
To be fun. Like, why should wine have to be so serious all the time? Like, yeah, once in a while, you would want like a big Bordeaux or something to go with your meal. But when I'm just hanging out, it's like, I want to drink stuff like this that's lively, fresh, exciting, juicy, low alcohol typically.
And I was going to say, one of the things I love, and you find that, like, if you go to France, the wine is typically lower. ABV, I'll say. Mm-hmm. Lower in alcohol, which, you know, means you can drink it.
That's that
kind of that's what the winemakers are looking
in
for,
in
too.
A much bigger way.
A lot of European alcohols in general. Like, my parents went to Germany. I went to Germany too, but I was not old enough to drink. Not fun. But my parents, when they went there, they were like, you can drink so much more beer and wake up with so much less of a hangover mm-hmm. because they mm-hmm. just treat the beer better. They don't, you know, carbonate the hell out of it. And it's
well,
much
and
more
nobody's
natural.
Going running around trying to create high ABV beers or even, you know, like these really, really robust alcoholic, like California wines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some people were, and I think that's why this is kind of such a big movement now, is to kind of get away from some of those really big overblown California wines that, like, the ones that kind of like Robert Parker was pushing with, like, lots of yes. the high point scores. And that's what I think so many people in it bled into Europe as well, trying to imitate those because people got a taste for these big, bold wines.
Right.
And
which previously just hadn't existed.
Yeah. Right. Or they would exist, but only in certain years or like mm-hmm. in certain climates. And then people who shouldn't have been trying to make those wines were kind of forced to make bigger wines where they normally made really delicate, pretty wines. And then like, but the demand from like consumers for a while was like, I want it to be like super ripe and
bigger,
big. And
fruitier.
So they would add sugar to boost the alcohol content. So it seemed bigger and bolder and yeah. riper. And I think that's where it kind of like a slippery slope.
Downhill.
Yeah.
Do you get downhill nervous from natural there. Wines in that regard? That, you know, natural wines will at some point hit that overexposure or jumping the shark point?
A little bit.
Well, they're not regulated. So
yes.
anybody can call a wine natural right mm-hmm. now. And there's not a lot of guidelines. So that's a question.
Yeah.
Like, so when does it become
I think
just
you're starting
speak?
To see it a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's not too bad right now, but you're probably going to keep seeing it more and more as this trend kind of picks up. And then there's going to be bigger ones who want to make sure that they don't lose any of that market share. So they're kind of, they're going to be kind of like putting out their versions of it. And who knows, maybe it'll be pretty good, but you don't, you know.
Well, we were even talking, you said like the organic wine, like everyone's just marketing it as organic, you know, and
yes.
we have a lot of people that come in like, so everything's organic here. And it's more than organic. That's the thing. It's not just about the farming practice. It's about the winemaking process. And so you can go into Trader Joe's and find a wine that says organic and
they
made
grew
with
the
organic grapes.
And they may be like certified organic.
Yes.
Which a lot of smaller wineries don't even, they're like farms. Mm-hmm. Like you're not going to go through those hoops and do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that just means the grapes are grown that way. They can do anything else they
exactly.
want. You know, you can add chemicals.
Very
organic grapes.
Very few
the
of the wines that we have the word organic stamped on them. We'll tell you when they are. And I mean, there'll be like a little seal on some of them that are certified. But the ones that say like organic on the front really big, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and so many like natural winemakers. I mean, biodynamic farming is big also in wines.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I mean, that gets a little bit, you know,
woo-woo?
Strange to people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo-woo is a good word.
Yes.
You know, because there's all these things about moon cycles and there are some interesting traditions that come along with that.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes organic to a different level because people are paying attention. In biodynamic farming, people are paying attention
right.
to what's happening with the weather and, you know, the natural cycles of nature and, you know, and not throwing a bunch of garbage chemicals on their
exactly.
plants just to get them to grow.
Yeah. So even if you don't really subscribe to the whole, like, you know, burying the cow horn or whatever, all those other things, mm-hmm. it's like, you can't deny that the moon has a huge effect on everything that
people.
We do. People, the tides, everything. Like, of course it's going to affect the crops and the way that things grow. And so, I mean, it makes great wine.
Yes.
And
yes,
even if
exactly.
you don't believe in
and
that, like, at least they're paying attention to it and they're taking a lot more care with it. So.
Yeah. And it's one natural way. And I mean, and I'm going to use the term natural, which has become so loosey-goosey
yes.
in our world. But I'm going to use it because I think it still describes, to me, like a process which is innately not artificial.
Exactly.
And so no matter what kind of farming they're using, biodynamic farming is one of the natural
mm-hmm.
farming methods.
Yeah.
And there are many approaches.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Just like anything else.
Like you were saying, it goes beyond how the grapes were grown.
Mm-hmm.
This is about what happens after the grapes are picked.
Yes. That's exactly, like, you can make the worst wine out of organic grapes if you're not doing it well. You know what I mean? Actually, I feel like 10 years ago when like organic wine started coming around, oh my gosh, it was so bad. It was awful. Like the ones you'd see in the grocery stores, obviously.
Like the $2 chuck and stuff like that.
I mean, no. I don't think that's ever. Well, do they? They might have an organic
they
one.
They do now.
Organic $2 chuck. Oh man, we need to run ourselves to a grocery store and find that right now.
Do a side by side.
Yeah.
We all love
and
that
I'm guessing.
One.
Yeah.
It'd be like organic Hot Pockets on some level. Like, you're eating a Hot Pocket. Yeah. Like, come on.
Yeah, that does not make you more virtuous.
Right? Like, yeah. I just feel like if you're eating the Hot Pocket, just go for the Hot Pocket.
Exactly.
Well, another myth with natural wines, or I feel like it's kind of a myth, and you guys are seeming to do well debunking it without even saying it, is that all natural wines are going to be so expensive.
That sound you just heard.
Because they do, they fall into this artisanal category. Mm-hmm. Like, people are hands-on, they're allowing wine to do its business, and but you guys really, like, you have a lot of wines that are $30 and under.
Oh yeah, like a lot. While we don't have much under like 15, our 15 to 25 range is really good.
Yeah,
right. Some of my favorite wines are in there.
Well and honestly, I mean, as someone who, if someone wants to drink wine often, you know, I don't know how many people buy bottles of wine over $30, like on a regular basis, mm-hmm. unless they really have a good collection and they're cellaring. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't normally drink a $50 bottle of wine on a Wednesday night.
No, neither absolutely do I. Not. You know. And when people come in, I have these things that I call like, oh, this is a good Tuesday night wine. And they they love that, you know? Obviously, we do have several bottles over 40.
Oh, I'm sure. You know,
but most of them are under 30.
But most are under 30. Yeah.
So that's like sort of debunking the myth that in order to have a good natural wine, it has to be.
No, I would say it's tough to get it definitely under 15. Like, you can get close, and we do even have like a box wine that's still made well that comes out to less than $10 a bottle if you. No.
But I mean, 50, in my world, I guess 15 is a manageable. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think going over 20 is where you start to see like kind of like that 20 to 30 range, I think, is where a lot of really good stuff
you kind
can
of
be
get
found.
Like sweet spots.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Both of these are in that 20 to 30 that we brought today.
Yeah.
But we're trying a new
wine now.
At least you and I are. These two are a little slow.
Yeah.
Do you want to
come on, guys?
Okay, hang on.
Dumping in this soup.
No, hey, it is a potato cheese soup, so adding some wine could actually...
It might be good.
Add some interesting complexity.
That wine probably would have been great with cream of potato soup.
Ooh. Ooh.
Look at him looking.
Again, it's juicy.
It's so juicy. This is one of our favorites, and it's...
And it doesn't have any sort of unnatural color.
And which one is this one, again?
So this one is... L'Air du Temps from Jean-François Cousin.
That's how I say
this. This is not a French podcast.
Thank you.
And I took Spanish in all through school.
See.
But no, this one's a all Gamay from Beaujolais. So, but kind of a good version of it.
And it on the nose, it smells.
There's a little VA, like, on which volatile acidity, like sometimes it tends to drop off a little bit, but I always kind of liken it to a little nail polishy, but not in an offensive way.
No,
you know?
You're right. There is a little bit of kind of that.
But this one,
this
one
tang
smells
to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This one smells more like wine. Mm-hmm. However,
yes. True
on the nose.
If you're this feels like a good wine that, and on some level like an introductory wine, where mm-hmm. like if you drink reds, you could probably move over to this and feel pretty comfortable.
Would hope
but
so.
But also,
yeah.
you'd also be tasting really. It would taste different to you.
It's like crushed up cranberries and sour cherries, and
it still has that little bit of effervescence.
And it's
too.
A little frizzly on your tongue.
Frizzly, yeah. I like that. Yes,
I don't know. That's what comes to mind. Frizzly.
And I like it because it has
refreshing.
That. It is a richer. It's a richer flavor, I would say, than the last one, mm-hmm. but without that like heavy tannin wipe out your mouth. Sense.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not at all syrupy.
No.
Well, and you notice we also have it a little bit chilled. A lot of the wines in the shop, even the reds, we recommend just chilling it a little. It doesn't have to be ice cold, obviously. That would be a mistake. But a little bit of chill on it, I think, really kind of livens it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, and they say that in this country, we drink our whites too cold.
And reds too
and our reds,
warm.
Or our whites too warm and our reds too cold.
No, other way.
Other way around.
Mm-hmm. So we like overchill those whites.
We overchill
our
whites.
Well, no wonder we're doing it. We can't even get the phrase right.
But people here also believe that you need to drink red wine warm.
Right.
Sometimes.
Sometimes at
warm
restaurants.
Warm is not.
Yeah, you see their wine, like their red wine is all like right on top of like the fridge where it's like outputting all the like heat.
Warm wine is not a good idea in any circumstance. Especially since when it sits in the glass, it's naturally warming up.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's
which is part of the fun to kind of just let it evolve and let it warm up and watch how it evolves as you're drinking it.
Mm-hmm. Like,
because it's going to change and you'll pick out different things as the temperature changes. So
just like coffee.
Exactly.
Like you can't taste anything in the coffee when it's hot.
Right. Too hot.
Too hot. Yeah.
But then once it hits room,
but if you talk to like Ryan from Pilco will swear, like you really need to get to that point to taste all the qualities in the coffee. And I think honestly, if you're drinking a really great coffee, that's probably the time when, let it get, you know,
a little,
cold.
Yeah.
He's like, oh yeah, I never drink hot coffee.
Whoa.
And I'm just like.
And not cold brew either.
That's a commitment.
Like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just really wants to know exactly what it's all about.
Yeah.
Whereas I drink a lot of cold coffee because I don't drink it fast enough and it gets cold in my cup and because I'm off doing something else. And I do. I always drink it.
I can't. And I love coffee, but it has to be either hot or like ice cold. No middle.
No middle.
Yeah.
No warm coffee. Where are you on the spectrum, Brad?
I can push it a little further than you. But I also, we also end up having to like keep like a Chemex on the stove on the lowest setting just to keep
warm coffee. It keeps it.
Yeah.
That's kind of like cheating, I guess, but
I've been trying to find a trick to
better
keep coffee because I have an 8-cup Chemex.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's too much coffee. You can't fit it all in a mug.
Right. Yeah.
And it would get cold there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But keeping it warm.
Yeah. A little
has been kind of a trick.
Little like, water in a saucepan, throw it in there low on the stove. That's what we do. Right. I don't know if it's ruining the coffee, but...
Probably just
I think as long as your heat isn't...
Direct.
As long as it's kind of soft.
It's like a double boiler, sort of.
And maybe you don't leave it there for hours.
Right.
Anyway, don't put your wine on top of your fridge.
No.
Cooler.
Or anywhere
Don't
hot.
Kind of leave it out. It should be cooler.
I see some Instagrams like of people like they have their wine like on the top of the stove, which I mean, it's their cooking wine, but still don't do it.
It still goes bad up there.
Yeah, just throw it in the fridge.
Yeah.
So you opened your shop, Nonfiction Wines, last year,
mm-hmm.
correct? How have you kind of seen the shop evolve and how have you kind of seen your clientele evolve over that year, especially because it feels like natural wines is really it's evolving, it's booming, there's much more knowledge about it right now than mm-hmm. even I feel like just a year ago. Maybe
it's been awesome, actually. Like, I mean, yeah, people come in with questions, but we had no idea when we were opening. Like, obviously there's restaurants, Strange Town, you know, Voyager, things that were kind of jumping onto the movement and really doing well with it. But we're like, is this going to work? Like, do people even care? And right away, it was like a huge thing. People are like, yes, you have this. Like, oh, people knew a lot more than we thought. Like, man, what a snob I was to be like, I don't know if people are going to get it. No, they get it. Like, it's great.
5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I feel like your surprise may have been warranted.
Uh-huh.
I feel like people have really come a long way over in wine overall.
Yeah,
more people drinking wine in Milwaukee specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And so many young people, like so many people just loving it and like, this is the only wine I like to drink. And we have people who they are like, we only buy our wine here now because we know we can walk in and every single thing is going to be up to the standards that we like to drink. You know what I mean?
Well, and talk about that because, you know, you guys not only are, you know, kind of maintaining a manageable price point, but because there isn't really regulation on this, what are your criteria for bringing in the wine that you bring in?
Well, we try to kind of like, again, judge it based on the wine itself. First, obviously, we want it to be something we like. And there are certain things that we do like that we sometimes don't fit the mold. And we can kind of pass those by because we are a small shop and we don't really have room for everything. But we do like to make sure that it's at least practicing organic. A lot of them are certified and sometimes they'll be certified in a maybe in their home country, not here, or vice versa. And like, that can be kind of a murky thing, but you try to trust or work with importers you trust who wouldn't work with anybody that would even kind of touch it. I think that's kind of a big thing. If you can't visit it. I guess
someone along the way kind of needs to know the purveyor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we sadly don't get to go meet all the winemakers. That would be amazing, but someday.
Right?
Someday,
a good portion of them, though.
Yeah, but you know, the distributors we work with, we trust 100% to be telling us the truth, to find out these facts for us. Like, how are they farming? What are they adding? What are they not at? You know, that kind of thing. We don't work with anyone that we think is just trying to sell us something, just to sell us something.
And you can kind of. You can kind of tell
you
when
can
that's
tell.
Happening.
You can
kind of when they're you're kind of just like,
the
so
word
what about
sustainable
the...
is not really murky. In our shop. It's sure it's fine and maybe it makes some great wines for other people, but we're so small, we have to really lead with what we believe in. So we do have a hard yes or a hard no. And I think that's okay. You can get the other wines at many other like great shops around this area, but
yeah. And so we always try to keep it to no chemicals in the vineyard, all like usually like then hand harvesting, all fermented with the native yeasts. And then from there, just not really messing with it or trying to do as little as possible. Yeah. So,
which I don't know. I mean, I probably romanticize this a little, but I like the idea of going into a process, you know, and it's kind of like naturally fermenting charcuterie or bread where you're there. The wine is alive. You're letting it do its thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be maybe unexpected. Like you could have a warmer day and a cooler day.
Yeah, exactly.
Things will all impact like what's in there. And like sometimes there's a weird little natural, like what you normally consider to be an imperfection that actually turns into something awesome.
Absolutely.
That you would never, ever, ever allow in an industrial process. Of winemaking.
What is that one wine that we have that was like kind of an experiment that was like forgotten for a long time? I don't remember what we had like a 1998.
Oh, it's the, probably the Rumorantin.
Oh, yeah. It's Brendan Tracy.
I think
wine.
It was just that he discovered a barrel that was left for decades, just unsulfured, just sitting there under the veil. And like it was still protected. It was like very slowly, obviously, like had this like oxidative quality, but it was.
And probably be concentrating because they were
But it was still tasted nice and fresh lively and it wasn't
my style. Yeah. But I can respect it that it's
well,
very cool.
I'm gonna blank on the name of it. But there's a wine, loosely described as a wine. Mm-hmm. I think the French would like to say no. This is not. But it's a mix of a wine and a cognac. It's by Pierre Ferrand, and it was an accident.
Okay.
I think the story goes that. Some things were combined that shouldn't have been. And it turns out it's a beautiful, like sweeter dessert wine. It's not in the natural category. Yeah. But I feel like, you know, when everyone went, oh, that's not a wine, but they still make it because some people really
love it. Yeah.
You know,
it's great.
Accidents are good.
They can be. Yeah. Happy accidents is a thing, you know?
Do you have, so for people who can't necessarily make it to your shop, maybe they're not even in the Milwaukee area. What do you, if you're wanting to seek out and explore natural wines, what kind of questions should you be asking? I mean, I'm gonna make the presumption that you can find like an independent wine or spirit shop, you know, where you are.
Yeah.
So what should you go in with?
An open mind.
Yes.
Well, what can you ask to kind of...
The first thing, and maybe it's not really asking, it's more of something that you can look for. And I mean, everyone tells you this. Number one tip is look for the importer that you like.
If you don't have anyone to talk to.
If you don't have anyone to talk to. So that's flipping the bottle around and looking at who's importing it. So like we mentioned, Louis Dresner, Kermit Lynch, probably the main ones in our shop. We have Jenny and Francois. We have Zevrovine. We have Fifi. So just like these are some really cool ones that you know that they're bringing in good winemakers.
Are there any that you would steer people away from?
Not really, because I think that category could be too large to figure it out. Because I think
and it's probably a generalization, and there may be some gems.
Oh, right,
of course,
collections.
And
as
there
well.
Are, yeah, there. It just depends, and I think that's why you kind of start to follow. Like if you do get a good one or something you like. Kind of take note of the producer and the importer, and you could look for something familiar again. Like look, because their tastes are probably going to align with what you liked. Like if you liked this one that they bring in, chances are they're, you might like their other ones. So mm-hmm. that's exactly. kind of a good shortcut when you, if you're like scared to even ask questions and right. you just kind of want to like turn the bottles around and look
and
at them.
Actually look.
Right. Yes.
But and otherwise, I would say just come in and start trying to open it up. Tell us what you like and what you don't, or tell the person in the shop and hopefully they can actually like try to remember maybe something that like, this is my favorite type, or I would like it to be like in this world and I would like it to cost about this much.
Exactly.
I think that
cost
also helps.
Is a big one. But like, for instance, for you, I would tell you to now, next time you go into any wine shop, you walk in and you're going to be like, I like juicy, light-bodied, fruit-forward reds, maybe a little funk on them, like things like that. Those are great.
I do like to use the phrase, maybe a little funk on them.
Yeah, I know. So. I heard you say it like three times. Yeah. I was kidding.
And see, I like to walk into wine shops and go, I just want something that's different.
And that's great.
You know, I like minerally. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, but let's do something that's a little bit weird.
Yeah.
And usually what happens is the person goes, oh, five things come to mind. You know,
yeah. Yes,
these are the things that wine people geek out about. I didn't know that until, you know, but I was just kind of tired of drinking the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's way more fun for someone to come in and like say, I don't know, something that's cool, weird, something that you're excited about right now. How about that?
Yeah. Not just what's the best red?
Yeah, we get a lot of that. What's the best wine you have? I don't know.
They're like, really good.
That depends who you are and what you're eating
and what you want to spend and all of, you know, so... and when we ask that price point, it's never to be like, oh, we want you to spend the most money. It's like, no, honestly, like if it's a Wednesday night and you want to spend $16, that's fine. I'm not going to judge you. I do that all the time.
Yeah, most of us kind of have to.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm never trying to push anyone to like extend their budget.
No. Well, and this doesn't have to be snooty. You know, I mean, I think when trends come along, everybody's like, oh, we're drinking natural wine because so-and-so is drinking natural wine.
There's a nervous exclusivity about it. And some of that's self-imposed by people. Like I will say as someone who, this is my first experience truly with natural wine. And it's one of those things where you get nervous being like, oh, well, I don't know it and I don't want to waste it and I don't want to feel like an idiot for ordering it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'll just stick with what I know or stick with what I'm familiar with. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I think... a lot of those, that feeling of exclusivity can feel self-imposed more than imposed by other people.
Definitely.
And I feel like this is not any different than experimenting with regular wine. Like, you know,
no.
I mean, 20 years ago, I don't know, 15, I don't want to make myself too old. Maybe I'm trying to think. A while back, you know, like when we're all picking out wine based on how cool the label is or, you
which
know.
Which still happens.
I mean, you're still drinking across... mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you're just trying things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you figure out that the cool labels aren't always the good wines.
Right.
But sometimes you find a cool label that's also a good wine.
Yeah.
We do a lot of cool
ones.
Or
that you like, you know. So tips on buying, tips on storage.
On buying, I mean, and this is easy to say as someone who like, this is my livelihood and this is what my passion is. But don't just buy the same bottle every time. Yes. Like your tastes don't grow if you eat the same food every day. Like you have to push yourself a little bit. So we're really good at that, at helping you. Oh, you like this wine. Seems like you like this region. Let's try something else. So I would say just even if you go and you're like, oh, I'm going to buy two bottles. If you're really stuck on that one that you love, buy that one and something new. You know,
always be kind of like use that as your way to bridge that gap. Just kind of like this one I have to have again. But like,
or
don't
I have
don't
people
just
for
go,
dinner, so I'm going to buy that one because I know it's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah, just get to know the regions that you like. Get to know the styles
or
that you like.
And producers, and you can try other things from them. And
storing.
And storage. Because not everybody, and I guess that was my point before, is like, you don't have to be a wine snob and have like a wine cooler with climatic temperature and, you know.
Just as long as you're. Yeah, looking to keep it as
away
from light
store?
And heat. Mm-hmm. I would say is, whatever.
Not on
your
fridge.
Yeah, not on top of the fridge.
Yeah.
But also, just keep it away from light and heat as best as you can. If you have a fridge, that's great, like a dedicated wine fridge, but even just try to get it as like into your basement or somewhere dark and not hot.
Yeah, we just keep ours in the basement.
I was going to say, a few months ago, you could have used the classic Wisconsin fridge.
Leave it outside.
I told people to do that, like just for over like the holidays. I'm just throw it in your garage or outside for a little bit when
And you can, because you can throw it in your fridge, but it's probably going to be too cold.
Yeah, but then just pull it out, right? Like
pull it out, like an hour. How long do you need? An hour.
It depends on the wine. Mm-hmm. I feel like a white, you could go a little bit closer to that. Like you could open
drink
it up. You
sooner.
Could still, oh, yeah. You could still drink it right away if you want, but it also might need a little bit of time to warm up. Reds, even if you're storing it somewhere else that's not hot, if you didn't have room in the fridge, throw it in just for a little bit before you drink it. Like, I think the rule of thumb is usually like 10 or 15 minutes on both sides. Like, pull the whites out a little bit before you'd want to drink it, or put the reds in a little bit before.
I just think of it kind of like cheese. Like,
yeah, you gotta
drinking
let it come.
Cold or drinking. Eating cold cheese.
Drinking
is
cold
not
cheese is even
either.
More.
Drinking is, cold cheese is, you know.
It caused a huge, I know this is not wine related, but really quick. Oh my gosh. So Christmas Eve, my parents are cheese fanatics and wine fanatics, of course. But we went to see my niece's Christmas pageant and we were getting in the car and my dad, like, we forgot to take the cheese out of the fridge. And it was like, it ruined Christmas for him for about 30 minutes. So yes, cheese has to be taken out before.
Yes.
Just about the wine.
Yes. So when you take out your cheese, take out your wine.
Yes, and then you'd be set.
Yes. What are, I don't know, closing thoughts? Do you have any more questions,
Ben? Well, most important question, where can we find you guys?
So we are at 800 East Potter in Bayview, right off of KK. So
yeah, Bayview!
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you're right nearby, like Honey Pie and Rushmore, we're just right around the corner. Awesome. Just a few steps off, so.
And you guys are also online? Social media?
Yes. Social media, we're working on the website.
Website's almost done.
I don't have the skills for that.
None of us do.
It's hard. Oh my gosh. But we do try to, especially on weekends, we try to have something open for people. We always want to pour samples and have a discussion. We're doing a lot of Friday night tastings lately, which have been really cool. Usually highlighting either a region or a producer. And I always make snacks, so... Well, that's helpful.
Yeah, something I don't think we've talked about yet is there's a lot of really interesting regions with natural wine that are kind of untapped.
Oh, yeah. I think I was saying before we started talking that some regions have come up, I think, with the natural wine movement that are maybe unexpected for people who haven't explored. Like
a lot of Central
like Austrian,
Europe. Yeah.
Austrian wines and Georgian wines. Like
Georgia the country, not Georgia the state.
Yes.
Important note.
No, Georgia the state. Great wine.
Peach wines.
Yeah, Georgian wine is huge. And people in Milwaukee are really jumping on. I mean... Voyager just had a big Georgian wine tasting on Monday.
Strangetown, I think, always has something from Georgia. Like, so they always try to have something like a little bit more intense like that too, which is kind of nice because it's like...
Well, talking to Pam, she's like, people come in and they're like, they want the weirdest orange Georgian wine from Strangetown.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty crazy.
But it's great because it kind of primes them up for like the one that we had earlier, I feel like is somewhere kind of in the middle. Like we have ones that are like a lot even lighter on like the skin contact. And some from Georgia and some other, like, in Italy that would be a little bit longer. And then, like, the one that we had today was, like, kind of on, like, the earlier side or a little
softer, yeah.
Yeah,
and orange wine, like, I feel like orange wine is a natural thing for, I mean, people who drink rosé explore orange wine.
Exactly.
Because it's kind of the same idea.
It's almost
like a reverse. You would not believe how many people come in to buy orange wine. And, like, we don't sell that much rosé. I mean, obviously, it's not the season. I can drink rosé whenever. But, like... Our orange wine just flies off the shelves. And the rosé is like, maybe I'm over it. I'm like, what? It's still good. But whatever.
Rosé kind of...
Summer hasn't come
Rosé
around,
kind of jumped the shark a little bit as a wine...
I'm shaking my head at you, but...
Oh, no.
what happened is it didn't jump the shark. It's just that places started carrying it all year. Well, and when it went from being seasonal to being carried all year and the whole rosé all day hashtag...
I think that's the problem.
The kind of, that's
that
what
is
I mean the problem.
Because you can drink it all year and it's going to be fine. Yeah. It's going to be great. Sometimes it's even better. It was a
but
little
I feel
time.
Like that the availability of it prompted it to suddenly become... Like,
and
not
got,
the so, thing that people just
and it got
do.
Really commercialized to, like you said, with the rosé all day. Mm-hmm. And it became about, you know, cute wine labels as opposed to actually
just
good
the
wine.
Bad ones.
Or just something pink as opposed to like wanting some, like people who won't drink white wine that will drink rosé. Like,
people,
I think that I've noticed
white,
some of
the
that
white
too.
Zen drinkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
can rosé all day.
A little bit was of a snootishness too, because I think there was this idea of like people who drink rosé, basic.
Like, well, yeah, that whole like, I don't know if I should say this, but that whole like white girl wasted thing. That was like the rosé thing. Yes. And I mean, rosé can still be just an awesome, awesome wine.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of sad it got popular because the things that get popular.
Look at you, hipster Lori.
I know, I liked it before it was cool. I did. I know, me too.
Sold out, Lori. It's sold out.
But now you're just a rebel for drinking it.
Yeah, I was going to say, now my backlash is I'm going to keep on drinking this, even though, you know.
Exactly. You like it. It's good.
If that makes me a little basic, fine.
Yeah, who cares?
Lori on a balcony just yelling drunkenly down at the drink people below her, just like, you've ruined this
but
for
that's
me.
That's perfect. Saying, drink what you love. I don't care if you like, find the thing that you really, really dig.
Yes.
And drink that. I'm not going to judge you if you like sweet wine. Some of the best wine in the world is sweet wine.
I don't want it all the time, but it makes sense at a, you know.
Yeah, time and place.
Because people come to wine in a different way. Like I used to think I was just a red drinker. Mm-hmm. And then I found really interesting, because I thought white wine was pretty boring.
Yes.
Well, it turns out I was drinking the wrong white wine. And then I drank a white wine at an Asian restaurant in Chicago that had in this description that it was notes of lead pencil. And I was like, I need to drink. I don't know what. Well, you know, we needed to drink a white wine.
Reads that and is like, give me some of that. Graphite, give me.
So, no, and it was amazing because you did. I mean, it was a way of saying like, this tastes like mineral.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
It's very mineral forward. It was, and I was like, whoa, that's cool.
Yeah.
You do actually kind of taste lead pencil in there. So people come to wine in all different ways. And I feel like natural wines have just come on, like as people are getting away from, you know, the craft cocktail movement had its moment with people were reclaiming classic cocktails. Mm-hmm. Everybody was wearing like stuffy little bow ties and, you know, twirling their little mustaches and being snooty, you know. And now you can get a really good craft cocktail and there is no snooty mustachioed bartender.
Definitely.
You know. And wine has kind of come the same way.
Like, yeah.
At this point,
younger people are drinking this. Drink what you like.
Right.
Experiment with things. Try something new. And I feel like natural wines, it's the perfect time for them.
It is. And we really try to take away the snobbery. And not that anyone else is doing something like wrong, but it's like, it should be just a fun experience and a way to kind of explore what you like and don't like. It shouldn't be, I feel like I have to know all of this before I can even go into a shop. That would suck. I mean, I would have never gotten into wine if I had to know everything. I don't, yeah.
Well, and this idea of knowing everything, like you're never going to know it. And if you think you do know everything, you're boring.
Yeah.
You've not been drinking enough different things. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So drink wines that are good. Drink wines you don't love. You know, you'll find what you love and what you don't love.
Exactly. Talk to your bartenders, talk to the people in the stores.
I have to say, Lori, I'm starting to feel bad for craft cocktail people who do have mustaches. Because every podcast...
There are a couple.
The last as three we've recorded, we've been like, you know, those snobby mustachioed craft... Like, we know about people we don't like. They have mustaches.
They're just crying.
Well, if they're twirling them, you should be skeptical. You know, this sort of snarly, like I'm looking down on you with my twirly mustache. No, and I mention it because I think that was a put off for people, especially people in the Midwest. Like nobody wanted like a really well dressed fancy bartender.
No one wants snidely whiplash behind the bar. Yeah.
Right. I mean, maybe some did. I don't know. Some people enjoy the
it's
the
fine
snobbery.
If the bartender themselves is a nice person.
Yeah.
If they have a good if they're welcoming.
They get one point off for twirling.
Yeah.
But
this is not an anti-twirling mustache podcast.
And if you're a great person who twirls your mustache and makes it amusing, all the power to you.
Yes, perfect.
Yeah. So what we're saying is Raleigh fingers, you can keep your job as a craft cocktail guy.
I'm just saying, like, anybody who has misconceptions about where craft cocktails have gone, like, who hasn't been to a craft cocktail bar because they were like, ugh, those people. Mm-hmm. Those people aren't there anymore.
You know? Yeah, which is kind of nice because then you can
really
go and get really good cocktails.
Amazing cocktails.
We haven't gotten cocktails in a while. We should do
that. We only do when the wine list isn't
so
good.
Can, yes. Right. And you can go get really amazing wine, you know, from places like Nonfiction, and nobody is going to frown at you if you have never had a bottle of wine in your life.
No, not at all. Like, that's actually easier.
Or if you think you don't like wine, you know, because I meet people who are like, ugh, don't do wine.
We do have some people that come in and they're like, I don't like wine. Like, then why? but usually why I can find them.
The first inclination is, why are you here? And then you think, well, they're here.
Because, yeah, they want to try it. And yeah, I had some really cute people come in the other day, and they're like,
cool.
We don't really know much about wine, but we heard that this tastes kind of juicy, and we're like, cool kids, so let's try it. I was like, that's adorable, and yes, let's find you something.
Yeah. It's weird that you were the person helping me that day.
I saw this rosé all day hashtag, and
you might have here some of that. I am.
Sounds like you need multiple bottles to drink all day.
There we go. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Thank you
for feeding me alcohol before I have to drink wine and watch The Bachelor tonight.
And for sharing your knowledge.
That too. That's the
important
part.
I think that people are mystified by natural wine, and there's probably not a good reason for that.
No. I mean, it shouldn't be any more complicated than any other wine, but I guess when you have something...
We standardized it to the point, though, where people think they know what to expect now.
Yes, true.
Which is a weird, silly thing that you shouldn't expect of any wine.
Yes.
But
it's always a gamble. When you pop a cork, you shouldn't know exactly what it's going to be. You know, it's going to change. It's going to evolve.
Well, and that's fun.
Exactly.
Like, you know, from year to year.
Aww.
And from year to year, wines should change. Like, the weather was different. Mm-hmm. Vintages change.
Yeah.
I don't know. Cool. No, so thank you guys for
thank you so much.
What you do.
It's super fun.
And where can people find you on social media? Because we didn't actually get there before.
Our Instagram is nonfictionwine.
Yes.
And same with Facebook. I don't know what the website's going to be yet.
It's something like that, .com.
Yeah, .com.
All right. And this is about truth rather than fiction,
yes,
correct?
Exactly, yes. Right.
So is there a deeper story on the name?
No, that was actually it. Like, we were playing around with some, like, cute little things, and I had one that I was obsessed with. But then Nonfiction came to
What was the one you were obsessed with?
I don't know if I should say. Okay. It was Wild Animals, because I thought it was super cute. But that's more of, like, a bar sound. But Nonfiction, we were just like, it's literally, like, it's just the truth. Everything is plainly out there for you. Like, that's the point. And we also kind of wanted to tie in a little bit of... we have books that people can come in and borrow.
Oh, cool.
We have tons of natural wine books.
You have a lending program?
Yeah. It's not like anything.
If you're interested and you want to check it out, feel free to take it and bring it back. But
it's the nonfiction wine's little free library.
Exactly.
Yeah. Only, you know, let's bring it back.
There are certain books I feel like you should buy and go out and get. But if you just want to dabble or look through something and like, you're just kind of curious, like, feel free to see if you like the tone of one. And then, you know, go buy your own copy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And truth is always stranger and more wonderful than fiction.
That's what they say.
Yeah. There we go.
Thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to drink the rest of these wines. And that takes us to our second spirited second, brought to you by Bittercube Bar and Bazaar. And I must say, this might be our scariest one. I don't normally use the word scary in describing beverages, but I will admit I'm a little scared this week because this week, Brandon Reyes, Bittercube Bar Manager and Research and Development Manager, otherwise known as the Bar&D Manager.
Yes.
He is feeding us some Malort.
I'm unafraid of this.
I know, Lori. I love you, Lori. And I mean this in the kindest way. But like, it just kills me how much you're like, I love Malort. And I'm just like, oh no.
I don't know that love is the right word. But I can appreciate it.
Okay. I have a harder time with this. But that's why we brought in Brandon Reyes to help explain how one can better appreciate Malort. Thank you for joining us.
Or maybe not. I mean, he might be surprising us.
Yeah, you're also like, I hate this. I don't know why I chose it.
Yeah. Well, I know why I chose it, but I definitely am not a Malort drinker. But as I was thinking about what to bring, I happened upon this bottle that was given to me by my boss, Ira, of a Malort.
This is the Ira Koplowitz.
Yeah.
Of Bittercube fame.
Yep, correct. And so this Malort was created, the original recipe was created by an ex or a former Violet Hour employee, which is how I assume it got into Ira's hands. Because,
interesting.
And what is the Violet Hour for people who do not know?
Violet Hour is one of the original and best cocktail bars in the country, and it's located in Chicago.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was the birth of the modern craft cocktail movement.
Right.
Was born in Yeah. So it's probably been around for 15-ish years.
Something like that.
Probably neither of us remember exactly, but
is that also where the Malort craze started? Because I know Malort and Chicago have a real big tight bind.
Yeah. As I was researching this, it seems like it's always been a thing, and production I think outgrew the operation that they had in Chicago in the 80s. And so they moved production to Florida.
Oh, interesting.
Or when I say they, I'm referring to the most famous and popular brand, and actually the only product that is legally allowed to call itself Malort, the Jepson's variety.
Yes.
So this one here, actually, they had to change the name of it to Besk.
Oh.
Because Jepson's had a trademark on the name.
So what makes something, well, a Malort, I guess. Malort isn't a thing. Malort is a name.
Yeah.
But what is it?
It's wormwood schnapps.
So, oh, okay. So it's a bitter liqueur.
Yeah.
Effectively.
It's a bitter liqueur. Lord, okay. We drank this. We know it's a bitter Malort.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but bitter liqueurs have made a comeback in terms of people's enjoyment of them just by themselves. I mean, you know, and things like classic bartender shots, like Fernet is, you know, a bitter liqueur. I mean, mm-hmm. Italian Amari, you know, are bitter liqueurs. And Malort just happened to be, you know, one of the ones that people really have not necessarily grown to appreciate.
It feels like the most aggressive of all the kind of bitters in terms of unadulterated wormwood flavor.
But last week we talked about vermouth, and you were talking about wormwood wine.
Right.
And does this have...
This? So
is this connected to that somehow?
Yeah, by wormwood. Okay. So there's a little bit of a theme with my selections, and that theme is wormwood.
This week we're going all
which
in.
Doesn't yeah. you know which in and of itself does not sound appetizing.
No,
so if you were going to describe wormwood as a flavor, what would you say that it tastes like?
It's minty, woodsy, and extremely bitter.
All right. Well, I don't think we can postpone it any longer. I think let's all take our swig. So this is like a... Do you drink this like a shot, or like is this a sipper in its current form?
This one's a little higher proof than the classic Jepson's. Oh. Jepson's is 34%. This one's 50%.
Laura just drank it and made a face.
You will make a Malort face mm-hmm. when you drink this.
All right. You next, Brandon.
All right.
Well.
Oh, he downed the whole thing. No face. The eyes are bugging out a little bit.
He's just gone stone.
The eyes were doing all the emoting for him. And now it is my turn. Oh boy. I have an interview after this. I'm interviewing somebody, so
this will give you courage.
Yeah, no, sure. That's one thing it'll give me. Maybe a buzz too.
So do you feel this like this is on the minty side? Like at least on the very end.
Wow. It's a lot. Oh boy. Yep. I don't have a Malort face. I have a Malort voice, apparently. It's very minty. That was very mint forward. But weirdly enough, I think I might like that more than I like original Malort, because the mint kind of helps mask that wormwood, that tree trunk flavor that people ascribe to Malort. It has a little bit more to it other than just finishes, like mainlining that
it
Malort.
It finishes more pleasantly.
Yeah, because you don't
quite
have... what
I think you have. So you don't...
It's still abrasive. If you don't like Malort, you know, like if you're violently against Malort, you probably won't like what we drank. But I think that was... I didn't hate that as much as my voice changing and my dramatic drinking
This is available on the market now.
Yeah, it's called Besk now, BESK.
Okay.
With a umlaut over the E.
Oh, like Besk.
So it's German, Germany, German-esque.
or
was it Polish?
Polish.
German-esque.
German-esque, yeah.
European.
But Leatherby is the producer of that.
Okay. And the, and you said this was invented, or the flavor profile was created by the bartender from Violet
Yep.
Hour?
Yep, of this variety.
So this is a newer... Malort has been around forever, and so this is a newer kind of take.
Yep,
on a wormwood, newer take. On a wormwood-based Yep. liqueur?
Yeah.
And are there other things in this...
It's like star anise and grapefruit, I believe, okay. which you can definitely taste. It's it's more of a nuanced and complex take on the style,
yeah.
whereas the Jepson's is pretty just
straight up tonic.
Yeah.
yes. Yes.
Well, I've learned a lot today that I found a version of Malort that I can. I wouldn't actively choose, but that I definitely like the kind of unique flavors. You can play with the flavor of Malort a little bit. You can mask it if you hate it. And also you can find flavors that play with that famous Malort flavor in an interesting way that, at least even if you do like retch a little bit like I did in a good way, like even if you have like that, like, whoa, that is a flavor, you're getting a lot more than just tree trunk.
Well, and there's probably an application in a cocktail.
Yeah.
There's definitely for bitter liqueurs. So, like, what would you envision?
Make a cocktail and then put the bottle of Malort next to it. like the martini style, just a whisper, wave the bottle over the cocktail.
Okay. Or follow with a shot.
yeah.
There we go.
No, this one actually, I feel like, would go great with grapefruit juice mm-hmm. and some sort of like a brunchy, salty dog sort of cocktail.
Interesting. So there's hope for people out there who think they hate Malort. There's hope for you out there. You can join Team Malort. I'm not quite Team Malort, but I'm closer to Team Malort than when we started this.
Yeah, and Team I would say Wormwood, there are so many bitter liqueurs that I would drink probably before this. But it's definitely, you know, it's got all those digestive sort of filling qualities.
Yeah, if you're stumbling around a city and you've eaten too much and you see a bottle of Malort on the bar, then by all means, that's gonna do the thing. It's gonna help you digest.
Well, huh?
Gets your fluids moving.
Because
your body thinks it's being poisoned as part of that. Mm-hmm.
See,
and
Lauren,
so
when
your
you
juices
say,
begin to flow.
When you say you respect Malort, and then you're like, when you drink it, your body thinks that it's dying and being poisoned. It's not a good selling point to me.
Well, it is though, because your body, the bitter things in general,
or,
like even like grapefruit, that bitterness.
If you happen to have worms, this is where the name wormwood possibly comes from. Farmers used to feed their chickens that had worms this wormwood, and it would, because it's an antimicrobial botanical. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they would give the chickens wormwood to heal it, to kill the worms inside the chickens.
This has been
appetizing.
But there's so many of the botanicals that are out there and that end up in spirits have medicinal properties that mm-hmm. have been used for centuries and centuries. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Drink it, get rid of your woes and your worms.
Well, thank you, Brandon, again for a truly enlightening spirited second brought to you by Bitter Cube.
Been a pleasure.
And Bazaar. And now we will never have to I will not have to drink Malort again for another year or two or forever. And that takes us to our food porn. We've been I'm really happy with the spirited seconds.
Yes.
We're learning a lot and we're drinking a lot, which is always fun.
Learning and drinking and learning.
That's my preferred
Actually,
way to learn.
I really like that hands-on approach. It's an interesting.
Yeah, and we've been drinking some really funky stuff that I probably would not go out of my way to try.
And I don't know if that comes out in that segment, but Brandon is a really smart dude and knows a lot of things about a lot of things. So, and you can visit him at the Bitter Cube Bar.
where he works on weekends.
And bizarre, yes.
But
not so bizarre.
Yeah, but before you do that, let's read a food porn. This food porn is called...
Our beverage porn.
Yeah, our drinkography.
Silky sweets.
I don't like it when you...
Liquid.
No. All right. This week, we are reading Drinking My Inheritance by Sarah Rohan.
Who must have been born and raised in Wisconsin.
Yeah, because this is about to get very Wisconsin.
And this is from the tin house.
Yes, literary. This is from your tin house collection. Because Lori apparently now is the holder of all.
I'm the harbinger of weird little...
You're going to die and people are going to be like, she's got a lot of sexual food books.
Or just good food reading books, like most of these are.
Yeah, no,
don't think this is the sexual Wisconsin old-fashioned.
No, this isn't going to be like, we were at Lambeau Field. I bet you there's got to be a porn. There's got to be like a book, like a romance novel written about
Lambeau Field. Oh, I'm sure there is. And there's people running their hands up and down the sexy, muscular football players.
And the cheese head throbbed with delight.
You mean his
piece
of string cheese?
Nothing else from that.
We could write our own cheese porn. That'd be fun. All right.
All right, let's not do that instead. Here's Sarah Rohan, Drinking My Inheritance. These old fashions were big and stiff.
Stiff.
As generous as the beers sold at Lambeau Field. With a pitch-perfect balance of sweet and bitter. Alcoholic warmth and ice cube chill. And they were apparently refreshing enough to drink all night long. Uncle Larry still measures his old fashions in brandy glugs and shakes of bitters and finishes them with 7-Up. He stirs them with cinnamon sticks and garnishes them with maraschino cherries. While he's still considered the authority on old fashions in our family, his heavily researched recipe is still the platonic ideal for us all. His typically Wisconsin version of the drink is to the original highbrow cocktail, what a double espresso latte with whipped cream and cinnamon is to a cup of Joe. Bigger. Sweeter. Got more spice. Smooth base brandy is at least as different from whiskey as an espresso shot is from a straight-up French roast. Except around the pool, where only plastic UW Wisconsin Badger football cups were allowed, these old fashions always came in ice-packed glasses, painted with pheasants soaring over marshes and spaniels, pointing at flocks of plump, deaf quail.
That is so Wisconsin.
That
is a beautiful description of the Wisconsin old fashioned, you often do not see.
I got an edit I got to make here. It's not called UW Wisconsin. It's UW Madison.
Well,
the UW is already Wisconsin. You have just said the University of Wisconsin, Wisconsin. It's not a thing. So, Sarah Rohan, sorry, got to burn this book now. Got to throw it all out.
Where are you from, Sarah?
Yeah.
Maybe she's from a part of the state where they call it UW Wisconsin.
The thing is, like...
I mean, there are weirder things we say.
You can either call
them
the UW Madison Badgers or you call them the Wisconsin Badgers.
Call them UW.
She called them a combination of both. But you know what? She wrote lovingly about Lambeau Field and old fashions made the correct way. So I ain't gonna argue with it. I ain't gonna fight with it.
Nope.
Hey, Lori, where can people find Food Crush on the internet?
You can't.
Nope.
No food crushes.
Not allowed on the internet.
No, you can find it. You can find us all over the internet. We're Food Crush Pod on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can find the podcast where podcasts are found.
Yeah.
Where can they find you?
Oh, you can find me all over the internet.
I'm all over the internet.
Yeah, I'm everywhere.
Like a bad episode of
Food Porn. I'm like Google. I'm just everywhere. No, you can find me at A Man About Film on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Fair warning, don't use Lori.
Sorry.
Did you literally forget that you have a microphone?
No, I didn't on purpose.
That was one of the rudest
disturbing sound effects.
Yeah, that hurt me, Lori. That hurt me in the heart place. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I don't use Instagram very much, but still follow me there because I'll appreciate it. Lori, where
can and maybe someday he'll, you know, if you start talking to him, he'll actually.
Yeah.
You know.
Lori, where can people find you on the internet?
I am L-O Frederick on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Those are my primary places.
I purposely drank this.
You can dig me up.
Sparkling water way too loudly into the microphone. So I hope people enjoyed that.
There we go. So I didn't even notice.
This podcast is us trying to. You were trying to hurt my bit, and I was trying to hurt you bit. But all we're hurting is our listeners,
right?
Because they have to listen.
Sorry,
to
guys.
Sounds.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, sorry, guys. But also, we love you so much. Thank you for listening to the podcast.
We'll be better for you.
I cannot promise that. I don't know if I can improve as a person. Not a comment on how good I am. Comment how unhelpable I am.
All right, let's wrap this thing.
Yeah. I should not insult myself anymore into a microphone.
So, we hope you are having a beautiful, beautiful March day.
Yes. And as always, keep cooking and drinking.